Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight, and ask everyone to turn their phones off. Craig Emerson makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. He was most recently here last year, but he's always welcome, and he's back to talk on an important topic. So I'll introduce him very briefly. He studied economics at the University of Sydney. He obtained his PhD at the Australian National University. He worked in various roles as a consultant and academic, a public servant, a political advisor. But, of course, he's been the MHR for Rankin in Queensland since 1998. He held senior positions in opposition, but now, since the election of the Rudd Labor government, of course, he's in the ministry with many talents, but one of them is to have the longest title of anyone in the ministry. Probably the longest title of anyone in any ministry in the history of Australian Federation. The Minister for Small Business, Independent Contractors and the Service Economy, the Minister for Competition Policy and Consumer Affairs, and the Minister Assisting the Minister for Finance and Deregulation. And tonight, Dr. Emerson's going to talk for us on why productivity is not just for nerds. Dr. Emerson, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Jared and Anne, and it is wonderful to be back at the Sydney Institute, and if I could pay tribute to the Sydney Institute for the role that it plays in promoting intellectualism in this country and the contest of ideas, which is vital for our future well-being. Just a very quick note on the titles. What actually happened is that I was two of those, and then Kevin Rudd rang me up and said, I'd like to add competition policy and consumer affairs to your responsibilities, but we better do a nip and tuck on the other titles because it's too long. And I said, yeah, that's a really good idea, but we forgot to tell PM&C, the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet, and because they didn't know any better, it was gazetted that way, and that's why those titles are as long as they are. I did want to share with you some thoughts about productivity growth in this country, recognising that this is the most important public policy issue in my view, and yet it's also the most boring. So in order to rise to the challenge, I thought I would approach this somewhat differently and pose the question as to why productivity growth is not just for nerds, why it's not just a matter for pointy-headed people, that it is in fact really important to our future. Subjecting a normal, well-balanced audience like you tonight into a speech about restarting productivity growth, therefore, is surely a classic case of the revenge of the nerds. I can tell you that in the small country town of Barradine in northwest New South Wales where I grew up, there were two groups of boys at school. There were the cool guys and then there were the nerds. The Barradine girls liked the cool guys and they barely tolerated the nerds. I got appointed as leader of the nerds, mainly because no one else wanted the job. Leader of the nerds put you in the front line when the cool guys were looking for someone to humiliate. My challenge tonight, therefore, is to deliver a scintillating exposition of why productivity growth is important to everyday Australians, to all Australians, and not just nerds. Then, just when you're so excited that you just can't hide it, I'll explain why, against the deep instincts of many Australians, competition is essential to productivity growth in Australia. Productivity is just a measure of what we produce each hour that we work. Well, that's labour productivity anyway. If I were working in an ice cream factory, my labour productivity would be the amount of ice cream I produced each hour. But I'd probably eat half of the ice cream before I packaged it, especially if it was that Maggie beer burnt fig stuff, so I wouldn't be very productive. There is another notion of productivity, the old multi-factor productivity trick, or MFP for short. MFP picks up the benefits of technological change from new ideas like Maxwell Smart's shoe phones, and now the modern version, the iPhones. The old MFP is a really good measure of working smarter. Through the creation and adoption of new technologies and the development and applications of new skills and ways of organising business. Productivity growth from working smarter makes for higher wages, bigger profits and lower prices and better quality for consumers. Productivity growth is important because it was responsible for 80% of the increase in our incomes over the last 40 years. That's all of us, nerds, cool people, the lot. 80% of the increase in our incomes over the last 40 years. Without productivity growth, we'd be, in the words of Skyhooks, still living in the 70s, watching horror movies right there on our TVs. But as our population ages, productivity growth will again be called upon to do most of the heavy lifting and ensuring our future prosperity. I can illustrate that this way. Today there are 5 working age Australians for every Australian over the age of 65. By 2050, the number is expected to fall to just over 2.5 working age Australians for every Australian over the age of 65. So that's an indication of the ageing of our population. Working smarter, not harder, is Australia's productivity challenge. And that's why Kevin Rudd, as Prime Minister, put productivity growth on the national agenda in his series of speeches leading up to Australia Day. Working smarter involves a more highly trained and better educated workforce, working with better equipment and information technology, and new technological advances coming our way or yet to be imagined. Working smarter involves bringing in the nerds from the cold. Who knows, the next generation of Barrowdown girls might go for the nerds over the cool guys. It'll be too late for me, but for the grandsons of the nerds of the 1970s, it could be the dawning of the age of Aquarius, where the moon is in the 7th house and Jupiter aligns with Mars, when peace will guide the planets and nerds will rule the stars. But are we up to this productivity challenge? Judging by our miserable performance during the first decade of the 21st century, the answer would be no. But if we were able to repeat the sparkling performance of the 1990s, the answer would be yes. During the 90s, labour productivity growth for the whole economy grew at an average of 2.1% a year. But during the noughties, the decade just gone, labour productivity grew at just 1.4% a year. So 2.1% in the 90s, 1.4% a year in the noughties. And what about the old MFP? Well, multi-factor productivity grew at an average of 2.3% a year between 1994 and 1999, which is an Australian record. Australia had the second fastest growth rate amongst OECD countries for this period. Second fastest productivity growth rate amongst OECD period in that magic period of the 1990s. But during the noughties, instead of growing at 2.3% per year, multi-factor productivity growth fell away to a pathetic 0.2% a year. And it gets worse because productivity growth got slower as the noughties wore on. Between mid-2004 and mid-2008, which was the last recorded productivity cycle, the old MFP growth actually went backwards for the first time on record. We were less productive towards the end of the decade than 5 years earlier. Productivity was like an engine all fired up from the roaring 90s as we turned the bend into the noughties, but it began losing momentum into the noughties and almost ground to a halt in what was the last year of the previous coalition government. The problem we now have is getting the engine started again and the locomotive rolling along the tracks. During the period from the start of the noughties to the change of government in 2007, coalition government ministers at first denied there was a problem of slowing productivity growth, and then when the train was parked at the siding, they blamed one-off factors. It was the drought, it was the mining boom that involved a lot of investment but delayed increases in mine production. It was declining oil reserves that were costing more to extract. It was caused by low unemployment that brought less productive workers into jobs. Now, comforted by these one-off factors, the Coalition never really saw the need for and therefore never conceived of a comprehensive productivity-raising economic reform program. Like many political ruses, there was an element of truth in these various one-off factors. But they didn't explain all the fall-off in Australia's productivity growth. In fact, we now have estimates of how much they did and didn't explain. The Productivity Commission estimates that one-off factors explain about 70% of the decline in Australia's productivity growth in the productivity cycle that ended in mid-2008 compared with the previous one that I mentioned. Now, 70% might seem a pretty big part of the story of why the productivity engine stopped. But just consider this. Australia will experience droughts during the next 40 years. Our oil fields will continue to decline. And at some stage, maybe sooner rather than later, we'll have unemployment rates as low as those of the noughties before the global recession struck. And on the question of drought, the Bureau of Meteorology recently reported that much of Australia will be hotter and drier in the coming decades. We'll need to offset these one-off factors at times in the future because they're not necessarily one-off at all, just irregular. And what about the remaining 30% of Australia's productivity slump that is not explainable by these four one-off factors? Remember, small differences in productivity growth can make a big difference to national prosperity over long periods of time, especially in an ageing population. Now, the difference between Australia's average annual moderate factor productivity growth during the 1998 to 99 to 2003-04 productivity cycle and the more recent one was 1.3 percentage points. So if we take that difference, we take 30%, this is the unexplained bit of it, we get 0.4 percentage points. That seems like a really small number. But if we were to write off that 0.4 percentage points of productivity growth into the future, we would be sacrificing incomes of around $15,000 per Australian by 2050 in today's prices. And that's a total of $530 billion in 1 year alone in 2050. So that 0.4%, the unexplained bit, is really important. We can't just say, don't worry about it, it's a small number. It's not a small number when it comes to the compounding effect. Now, that's $530 billion in 1 year is a lot of squandered opportunity. It's a lot of money that could have gone towards lifting underprivileged people out of disadvantage. It's a lot of investment we could make in preserving our environment. But speaking of squandered opportunity, the absence of a productivity-raising reform agenda during much of the noughties directly contributed also to a sharp decline in Australia's productivity compared with the effort of the productivity pace setter, which is the United States. Before Australia's productivity boom of the 1990s, our labour productivity was about 86% of US productivity. By 1999, we'd gone from 86% to 94% of US productivity. So this is the big boom where we're caught up, substantially caught up to the United States. But by 2008, Australian productivity had slumped back to 87%, pretty much to where it was before the 1990s productivity miracle. We'd squandered all of the hard-won gains achieved during that 1990s productivity boom. Now, Australia probably can't fully bridge the productivity gap with the US in the foreseeable future for the simple reasons that first, the US has a much bigger home market which enables economies of scale, and also America is geographically close to other high-tech economies which enable the old MFP growth that's based on technological change. But the Productivity Commission suggests we might be able to close the gap to around 10 percentage points over the two decades ahead of us if we pull our fingers out, and that's not a direct quote from the Productivity Commission. But pulling our fingers out does mean achieving average annual labour productivity growth of 1.9% per annum over the next 20 years, which would be a repetition of our stellar effort of the 1990s. We need to do it again. Indeed, Prime Minister Rudd flagged the benefits of 2% annual productivity growth in his Australia Day speeches. That's what we need, 1.92%. Now, how do we achieve this 1990s productivity miracle? Some people say orthodox economics is pie in the sky. Others say it's neoliberalism gone mad. I say it works. In a classic economics textbook manoeuvre, the Hawke government began opening up the Australian economy to competition from abroad and at home. It floated the currency, deregulated the financial system, and began tearing down the trade barriers that had protected business from competition for decades. Then in the early 90s, the Keating government shifted decisively away from a centralised wage-fixing system by legislating for wage bargaining at the enterprise level. The Keating government followed up with national competition policy reforms to open up the economy even further. Bigwigs such as the OECD, the IMF, the Productivity Commission and the Commonwealth Treasury have recognised that this pro-competitive reform program, extended in parts by the Howard government, was overwhelmingly responsible for the 1990s productivity miracle. Just so that you know, the other major source of productivity growth was the revolution in information and communications technology beginning in the early 1990s when someone other than Al Gore came up with the internet. As a result of the reforms of the final two decades of the 20th century, which opened Australia's product markets to greater competition, we were ranked the most open economy in the OECD as a result of this creation of the open competitive economy. But having fashioned Australia's open competitive economy, it's hard to do that same trick twice. In the recent OECD regulatory review of Australia, the OECD noted that Australia had in fact been one of the best performing economies in the OECD over the past two decades, with 17 years of unbroken economic growth, an increase in its GDP per capita ranking from 16th place in 1992 to 8th place in 2007. So you can see the benefits of productivity growth. However, the OECD also noted that Australia's productivity growth had slowed markedly in recent years and urged Australia to renew its reform efforts. There is unfinished business in deregulation and competition policy, and the pressure is always on to protect parts of the economy from competition, pressure that must be resisted if we are to achieve those ambitious productivity growth goals. The formula for restarting productivity growth and getting it motoring again contains two elements: supporting new 21st century sources of productivity growth, while at the same time further increasing the exposure of the Australian economy to competition. Well, let's have a look at supporting those 21st century sources of productivity growth. International research shows that the most powerful sources of modern productivity growth in open market economies are education, innovation, and infrastructure. The Rudd government's productivity-raising reform agenda therefore includes investing in and reforming the nation's education and training system through the education revolution, and that will result in a smarter workforce, better able to create and to innovate. It's why the agenda includes supporting innovation, enabling businesses to lower their costs while at the same time selling better products and services. And it's why the government is investing in productivity-raising infrastructure. That's better roads, better rail, ports, broadband networks, enabling the delivery of goods and services quicker and cheaper. By supporting education, innovation and infrastructure investment, the government's seeking to improve the capacity of Australian businesses to compete internationally and at home against imports. I'll just talk for a moment about the education system. The government's education revolution is bringing in more market disciplines and transparency, better enabling poor performance to be identified and remedied. For the first time in more than a century, Australia will have a national curriculum, removing the absurdity of a single nation having eight different curricula. A light is being shone on poor school performance by the revolutionary MySchool website, not to punish underperforming students or schools, but to identify them and enable remedial support to be put in place. Early childhood development services are being expanded so that all children, regardless of the incomes of their parents, are offered the same start in life. And at the other end, the Commonwealth-supported university education places are being uncapped to allow institutions to vary their course offerings in response to the needs of students, and 711,000 training places are being provided under the Productivity Places program. The second source that I referred to is innovation. Competition acts as a spur to productivity growth by forcing management to search for cheaper and quicker ways of producing goods and services in the quest for market share and for profitability. Business managers who feel the heat of competition are far keener to adopt new technologies to ward off their rivals or to take market share from them. Managers who know they'll be protected from competition by a complicit government usually become fat and lazy and see little need to innovate. As their costs go through the roof from poor business practices, they simply go back to the well of government largesse, seeking and finding extra protection from competition. The poor old consumers, of course, are the losers, and quite often the taxpayers are too. Investing in innovation can be a vital source of productivity growth, but only in an open, competitive economy. Handing innovation funding to protected businesses is like supplying free cocaine to addicts. The more you give them, the more they need. Since the late 1980s, successive governments have progressively reduced import barriers for the automotive industry. All quantitative restrictions are now gone and tariffs are at either zero for imports from countries with which we have free trade agreements, and that includes Thailand and the United States, or just 5%. The Rudd government is replacing an inefficient R&D tax concession that rewarded lots of innovation that would have happened anyway, and the new tax incentive will provide increased financial support through more generous base rates of support, and unlike the existing scheme of deductions, the new refundable tax offset will allow small start-up businesses to get an immediate contribution towards their R&D. Turning now to infrastructure, we endured in this country an infrastructure drought, especially from the Commonwealth through much of the 90s and the noughties. A 2009 OECD report shows that Australia's investment in transport, storage and communications infrastructure as a share of our GDP fell between the 80s and 90s and fell again in the noughties. National investment in economic infrastructure averaged less than 4% of GDP between 1990 and 2007, only rising to 5% in 2008. Well, even if we were to assume that 5% is adequate, and it's clearly not, then the underinvestment in infrastructure over the last decade and a half has been at least $8 billion a year. Now, the government's $22.5 billion nation-building plan for the future, announced in the last budget, involves a major new investment in national infrastructure, including investment of $8.5 billion in expanding Australia's transport networks, road, rail and port infrastructure. But governments won't be able to finance all of the extra infrastructure needs of our growing population, nowhere near it. And so we're putting in place the institutional arrangements needed for a nationally coordinated approach for the future planning and development of Australia's critical infrastructure through Infrastructure Australia. Now, modern communications infrastructure is essential to productivity growth in the 21st century, and the National Broadband Network will, in my view, be an enormously powerful enabling technology for Australian business, but especially our small businesses, offering the prospect of lower costs and extended market reach. So I've covered the three sources of productivity growth in the 21st century in an open competitive economy. I'm now moving on to what we can do to push that open door even wider so that we really do retain and increase our openness to competition. Although we're now amongst the most open in the world, our businesses are still shackled by lots of productivity-sapping regulations. These overlapping and inconsistent regulations applied by different states and different levels of government are forcing businesses to operate not in one national market, but in eight state and territory markets. You know, in many areas, Australia's 22 million people face more internal regulatory obstacles than Europe's 500 million people. Now, our geography is too large and our population too small to be divided into eight markets, each with its own business regulations. The government's working with the states and territories on a regulatory reform program to move Australia to a single national market. Of the 27 areas of business regulation in that program that are being reformed, we expect to have finished at least nine of them by the 1st of July this year. That's one third of the program done just 1.5 years into a 5-year agreement with the states and territories. Now, by the time we've finished this exercise of reforming state and territory and Commonwealth regulation in these 27 areas, we will have replaced more than 160 pieces of Commonwealth, state and territory regulations laws with just 10 laws, 10 modern laws, 160 down to 10. And for the first time since Federation, the government has delivered a single national industrial relations system for the private sector, with the one exception of Western Australia, who we still hope will come on board at some stage. Businesses overall tend to prefer less competition to more. Life's easier and more predictable when there are no competitive threats. Now, consumers should prefer more competition over less, since competition restrains prices and improves the quality of goods and services available to them. In a democracy, governments are elected to represent the interests of the people, not business interests or other sectional interest groups. Big corporations in Australia often claim they need to become even bigger through mergers and takeovers to enable them to achieve the economies of scale needed to become national champions in tough competitive global markets. But is bigger necessarily better? It's true that cost-reducing efficiencies may be achieved through greater size. That's why our competition regulators often, in fact, approve proposed mergers and takeovers. But if in the process of becoming big, the competition is obliterated, the incentive to be efficient falls away. Costs are then not contained and consumers are ripped off through higher prices. National champions turn into national gluttons. Australia's big four banks have long wanted to merge into just two mega banks. They say to enable them to be national champions in the world arena. Thank goodness successive governments have ignored their protestations. Of the world's 100 largest banking groups after the global financial crisis, only 10 are AA rated or above, which includes Australia's big four banks. Our four out of a total of 10. A combination of bigness and poor regulation allowed global foreign megabanks to hide their shonky anti-competitive practices from an unsuspecting public. No Australian consumer wants less competition in the Australian banking system. They want more. Only the banks themselves want less competition through the dismantling of the four pillars policy that has in fact served Australian consumers very well. Now, in petrol retailing, Caltex wants to buy mobile service stations, arguing that Australian motorists would be better off served through a more efficient system. What they really mean is that the resulting business would be more profitable. Now, making bigger profits is fine, but not if it's at the expense of motorists. The ACCC has sensibly knocked back the application on the basis that it would be anti-competitive and could lead to higher petrol prices through further market concentration. In Australia's relatively small, remote and geographically dispersed market, there's this persistent tendency towards oligopoly or even duopoly. Until the Hawke government undid it, two airlines had a legislated agreement to carve up Australia's skies. Two banks remain the banker's dream. In the past, two big supermarket chains have benefited from barriers to entry, including restrictions on the entry of foreign rivals. Now, the Rudd government is tearing down those barriers, enabling rivals like Aldi and Costco to expand their presence in Australia. Removing restrictions on the entry of foreign supermarket chains is right up the alley of the open competitive economy. But while all that good work is going on, another set of government regulations is throttling competition, having created not eight markets, but thousands of little protected markets. I'm talking about planning and zoning laws. Planning and zoning laws might be shaping up as Australia's 21st century protection racket. They limit the number of competitors in the local market. Some of them even provide for objections by existing businesses against the proposed entry of rivals on the basis that the new competitor might damage the profitability of the privileged incumbent. So-called centres policies limit the location of retail outlets to a small number of precincts, usually including a major shopping centre, ostensibly on the basis of managing traffic and general environmental amenity. Now, if one supermarket chain gets the gig for operating in a designated shopping centre, rivals are excluded from setting up nearby. And until recently, the major supermarket chains entered into restrictive agreements with shopping centre owners, effectively to keep rivals out. Well, not anymore. With the encouragement of the government, the ACCC has prevailed upon the supermarket chains to remove those anti-competitive provisions in their lease agreements with shopping centres. More than 700 of those anti-competitive provisions are gone. Through the Council of Australian Governments, we're looking at the anti-competitive effects of planning and zoning laws. And I can say this, the New South Wales government is taking the lead. recognising that its laws have anti-competitive features and now about to do something about it. Now, while bigger is not necessarily better, bigger is also not necessarily bad. When Tony Abbott announced his great big new tax on everything to fund his paid parental leave idea, a 1.7 percentage point lift in the company tax rate for bigger corporations, his shadow ministers formed a procession to bag out on the big end of town. The Rudd government has no difficulty working with Australia's bigger companies in the quest for greater productivity through a seamless national economy as the foundation for more jobs for working Australians and greater prosperity for all. Bigness can indeed bring with it economies of scale. Bigness can be a virtue when the industry produces traded goods because the big companies are unlikely to be able to set the world price and competition from imports can restrain prices at home. But where the stuff being sold on the home market by a handful of big companies can't readily be imported and where there are high barriers to entry in that industry, the tendency to anti-competitive behaviour will be strong. Having just a couple of businesses in an industry isn't the end of the world if they are competing against each other ferociously. But if they and governments keep rivals out, look out for the great big consumer rip-off. Well, as a nerd from Baradeen, tonight I hope I've demonstrated that productivity growth is not just for nerds, it's vital to the well-being of all Australians. Today's productivity growth is tomorrow's prosperity. And today's productivity growth is poor. It has been for a decade. Productivity growth is about working smarter, not harder. The Rudd government's investing in the modern source of productivity growth, the talents of our young people, nation-building infrastructure and new ideas. But for that investment to pay maximum dividends, it must be made in an open, competitive economy. That's why we're moving to a seamless national economy, tearing down silly state regulations that divide our nation into eight markets. Successive Australian governments have for three decades opened up the national economy to competition in the quest for a single national market. And I'll leave you with this thought: competition is good. More competition is better. Thank you very much.
Many thanks, Minister, and thanks to Coors Chambers Westgarth for the use of this fine facility this evening. So we come to questions and discussion. We have till no later than 7 o'clock, so we've got plenty of time. I thought there when you entered the age of Aquarius you might...
I won't sing.
Come out with a song.
I won't sing.
You're known for singing a bit, aren't you?
Yes.
I heard you on radio.
That's right.
Very impressed, actually.
We won't do a reenactment from Casablanca tonight. You must remember this. No. Moving right on.
I'm very impressed, yeah. What about the big hits in productivity? I mean, you were involved in the Hawke government as a staffer, and in that period of the Hawke government, the Keating government leaving into the Howard government, you had some really big hits in privatisation and industrial relations reform and in competition policy. Now if you look at the productivity reports over recent times, the most publicity has gone to this decision where the government seemed to be saying that it was okay for people and who weren't so well educated to pay more money for books provided people in the inner city can go online. You've come out with a very impressive list of sort of medium to small things, but what about big hits in productivity? Are there any left?
Yeah, I think probably not in terms of the structure of the economy, because it's called catch-up possibilities. When your economy is very heavily regulated and it's got a lot of inefficient businesses because they are protected from competition, then when you start tearing down that regulation and those barriers to entry, businesses will respond and will become more efficient, and that's exactly what happened. There was a lot of pessimism, you remember, Jared, during the 1980s when this was going on. How will Australian business cope? Well, I actually think that one of the reasons that we managed to get through the global recession as well as we did is that our businesses had become used to coping with competition. So this was just another hit to them. But as I said in the speech, we opened the door, governments opened the door to competition. All you can do is push it a bit further and make sure it doesn't squeak back, doesn't come back on you. So you need to be vigilant and push it a bit further. And that's what we're doing with the areas of business deregulation and some of the other competition policy areas that we're working on. So there's not a big hit in terms of restructuring the economy. I think there is a big hit in education. and sensible investment in education that isn't just money down the drain through keeping all of the existing rigidities in place is potentially enormously powerful. And when I see in my area of Logan City, really talented kids, wonderful kids, brilliant talents, but basically have had inculcated into them that they're not very bright, you see both an important social imperative of encouraging them and giving them the self-confidence that they are, and then a productivity benefit of getting in and backing them and making those kids really productive into the future. So the one really big hit, I reckon, is education properly managed. And I do think Julia Gillard is doing a sensational job there, because she is taking on a lot of those rigidities and a lot of the conservatism in the whole education structure, which in the university level, and I'll finish on this, Max Corden has described as Moscow on the Molonglo, you know, the most sort of central, the greatest example of central planning that you can imagine, where previously people in Canberra used to dish out the university. You can have 27, you can have 43. Oh, look, you don't need 43. We'll take one from there. We'll give that to you, and then we'll get... Like, it's absurd. But that's all being opened up to.
There's a question down there. Yeah.
I'm going to say, you spoke about the gifts and what's available to us. We've had a lot of reforms in our institutions over the last 50 years, education, IT. The one outstanding reform is the one that concerns business greatly, and that is the legal system.
Mm-hmm.
New South Wales is the third most litigious state in the world after California and Florida.
We are moving to, we counted the 27, and I was thought I'd be merciful and not go through all of those. But in addition, there's two or three others. One is not-for-profit organisations, where we think we can do a lot better, and the legal profession. Modernising and having a national approach to the legal profession, removing unnecessary regulations there. Lindsay Tenner, as a trained lawyer, is passionate about this, so he's really taking on that job. But I can report it's going pretty well. We're actually getting support from the states on reform there, and there'll be more said about that, I think, as a result of the coming COAG meeting. I hope it will be anyway. It's not the end, but it's we're encouraged about the progress that's being made there.
Down the back.
When are
they going to tackle the lawyers? When are they going to tackle the medical profession? That's the greatest closed shop in the country.
Yeah, Peter Walsh used to call the AMA the doctors' union, and they didn't like that.
I mean, that's the area where we need most reform.
Look, I think, as in so many areas, you do need standards. You do need professional standards, of course, and we've got a very unfortunate case that people know about. So, of course, in professions such as healthcare, you need professional standards. This is tangentially related, so I'll mention this. One of the 27 is health workforce, so it's nurses, paramedics, and all that. Again, the number of laws that will collapse there into one is a sensational effort. Doctors is just, and specialists is that much harder, as you know, because the interests are very, very strong. And I don't pretend to understand all of the detail, but a lot of this, for some reason, is state-based regulation. And states often are very protective about all this. I guess if you're a politician and something goes wrong in a hospital, you maybe don't want to get the blame for that, because it's seen that somehow you've relaxed the standards, and the specialists say, we told you so, we told you you should never have relaxed those standards, as if there would never be an error if all the standards that are currently in place were kept in place. So politically, I think, politicians, ministers put their jobs on the line when they even start discussing this sort of thing, because those with a strong interest, which is in the one sense legitimate about obviously not having under-trained people involved, but another also serves a very protective role, when they arc up, it's pretty hard going for politicians.
You, of course, mentioned the productivity and prosperity.
Yeah.
Now, there are two aspects you didn't mention at all, and these are actually controlling or influencing both of them. Namely, the increase in population, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
Do we really need 2 or 5 million people, you know, to come to Australia every 10 years to keep productivity up?
Well, actually, productivity is how much each person produces. So population of itself is not a direct... It's just how much every person produces. So whether you've got one person or 100 people or 500 people, the point is we need those people to be productive as possible. The figure that I cited there, I think, summarises it. We do have a problem of the ageing of the population. Peter Costello, amongst others, but was very early on in putting this on the national agenda. He used the phrase that demography is destiny. The decisions that parents made in the 1970s and 1980s have led to the ageing of the population. Couples used to have about 4 kids each. Not each person, but each couple. And now it's about 1.8. Well, as far as I know. Now it's about 1.8. So it's halved. Now, this is not unique to Australia. We have a population ageing issue, which means, according to the intergenerational report, that while at present we have 5 working age Australians for everyone over the age of 65, in 2050 there'll be 2.5 working age Australians. Well, those 2.5 working age Australians will need to be very, very productive to support those over the age of 65 who may be too old to work, and also those who are too young to work.
And the second point, globalisation, you forgot globalisation, namely, there are various aspects. One of them is that many companies are closing down and going overseas. That will influence our productivity as well as prosperity.
If we were to retain the same industry structure as we had in 1900, we would be very unproductive. We would be basically producing lots of milk, and that's a good thing, but we wouldn't be doing it very productively. Parts of Australia are productive. New Zealand's productive in doing that in the areas. But if we were just said, no, we're going to keep that structure, we're not going to allow any industry to go overseas, we're not going to allow any textile, clothing and footwear industry to go overseas, what we'd actually be saying to a lot of Australians is, listen, you are going to get $4 or $5 an hour and that's it, because that would be their productivity. And it makes sense, therefore, for industries to move around according to the strengths, according to economics, the comparative advantage of different countries. And that's why we change in industry structure as time goes on. If you've got an open competitive economy, that tends to happen less painfully than if you've got a very rigid economy.
Minister, as a market economist, would you accept that the rollback of work choices is really going
No, I don't. And in fact, I believe that the Fair Work Act provides ample flexibility while basically providing that sort of safety net of protections. The Australian people, and I'll make a political point, voted in huge numbers against work choices because they thought it had gone too far. And we were elected in significant part because we said we would have a different system. Now, the Coalition has said the Fair Work Act is a return to the centralised wage-fixing system before Hawke got in. Well, that's just absurd. That's just absurd. Enterprise bargaining remains the central organising principle of the Fair Work Act. And I know, for example, in the area of small business, that although there's been some apprehension that there won't be the flexibility and so on, most small businesses are reporting to me, not without exception, that there is reasonable flexibility, that they can sit down and work out arrangements with their workforce. So I think what we have to do, Milton, is just peel away the political rhetoric of this and bear in mind that work choices, to a large extent was replaced on the 1st of July 2009. Now, that was in the middle of navigating our way through the global recession. The Fair Work Act proved very flexible in terms of an adjustment there. And the adjustment was essentially this, that instead of people losing their jobs, which they perhaps would have in the late 1970s in a centralised wage-fixing system, they lost hours. They negotiated with their employers, or the employer went to them and said, listen, we want to keep you on because you're a good worker. We don't want to have to go and recruit again when things come good. Can we just negotiate a reduction in hours? And that's what happened. So if you look at total hours worked, you'll find that there was a reduction, but we didn't get the unemployment rates of peaking at 8.5%, which was in the original budget forecast. In fact, it didn't reach 6%. So it just shows on the ground that there was ample flexibility, and there will be ample flexibility into the future.
But as Jason Clare, your backbencher, has pointed out, and his electorate, youth unemployment is 49%.
Yeah.
So you've got a problem with youth unemployment in certain, poorly
yeah,
educated.
That's right. Yeah.
Young men.
And the best way of dealing with that long term first is to ensure that our young people aren't so vulnerable when there is an economic downturn, and that's the investing in education with a proper institutional structures around it. And in the shorter term, we are actually engaging a lot of these young people as apprentices. So apprenticeships are sort of coming back into vogue. But frankly, I wouldn't say, Jared, and I'm not suggesting you're suggesting this, that this is a result of rigidities in the labour market, unless we go to removing the minimum wage altogether. And I don't think the Coalition is even arguing that.
Hello, Minister. Australia is blessed with vast resources. I was wondering what your opinion is on using resource productivity as a complementary measure with labour productivity to boost the overall productivity.
Well, in effect, what we have our natural resources, as you say. Let's, to simplify it, call them mineral resources, because that's where a lot of the activity is going on. Where they're very, very capital intensive, and that's what these big mines are, then actually labour productivity is very high in them, because you've got, three or four people or a handful of people driving around really big trucks and running the mines and all that sort of stuff. The issue that we'll face is that the growth of China will continue. And sure, there'll be interruptions and it won't be a smooth onward path, but it will continue. And India, we're in the right region at the right time. What we need to do is to be able to attract people into those very, very high productivity activities such as mining, rather than hold them back and say, through protective devices, stay in these industries, stay protected. And fortunately, we don't have that problem in Australia because we got rid of most of that protection. If people flow into those, then that's a good thing. What we do need, therefore, is the flexibility to make sure that people can go into those sorts of activities. They are very, very high productivity activities.
My question,
hang on, we've got to move on.
Here's a question here. Yeah.
Enjoyed your talk.
Thanks.
As Minister for Small Business, how do you feel and how do you see the internet as affecting what's going on in Australia? Currently, internet trading with overseas sources represents over 44% of all trading done on the internet. That's affecting small business in a major way, as you appreciate. 10% GST is not paid, and every day I can get on the internet and buy $1,000 worth of goods and avoid GST.
Yeah.
That's affecting small business right across Australia. It's a dichotomy. It's a problem on one hand, it's a cheap for consumers, increases productivity, but it smashes a lot of small businesses.
Yeah.
Do you have an issue?
Well, look, I think we do live in a global economy, a global village, and I understand what you're saying. The law at the moment is that customs will allow freight to come into this country valued less than $1,000, and it won't attract GST. I'd say let's use the opportunities of the internet rather than just the threat side, and I accept what you're saying, and the opportunities, I think, can be boundless for small businesses. I'll just give you a quick example. With this high-speed broadband network, 100 megabits per second, the opportunities for teleconferencing in the future for a small business will be very good. And you might have, in a local council area, one common user facility. It could be in the local council chamber buildings and so on. So instead of that small business owner having to, particularly in regional Australia, having to get on a plane and go and see everyone physically, they might do that once, make the acquaintance, develop a bit of trust and a relationship, and then use these high-speed broadband network teleconferencing facilities to conduct their business that way. Enormous cost savings, both time and air travel and so on. The second area related to that that I think that we should be, and we are supporting, Martin Ferguson and I, in tourism these days. A lot of small businesses involved in tourism. I think that when people make a decision about whether they're going to come to Australia or not, they know that we've got Uluru. They know we've got a beautiful harbour and a wonderful city here. They know that we've got the Great Barrier Reef and the wet tropics of far north Queensland. What they don't know for sure is the quality of the accommodation. And a lot of people want to know that. Now, if you click onto a website of a small tourist operator or a cottage or some sort of place, and all it's got is a static page, I reckon people say, I'm not going to buy that. I want to have a virtual tour. I want to go into this place. I want to look what the bedrooms look like, the bathroom looks like, what's the view look like. All of that's possible. And we're actually supporting small tourism operators in getting more sophisticated in terms of their offerings globally through the internet. So I accept your point. I'm not arguing against it. I'm just saying, on the other hand, there are some real opportunities there.
Your comments on education were very welcome. I understand that there's been a chronic underinvestment in the university sector in the same way as infrastructure has been neglected. Would it not be better to spend some of the money instead of primary school halls, putting it into the universities?
Well, the primary school hall program, this school modernisation program, firstly, I think, from my local experience, is really very important. The kids in the underprivileged areas that I represent are absolutely thrilled about these new modern facilities. And as much it's about the pride that they now feel in their school and a sense of, remember we were talking a little earlier about kids and self-confidence and so on, suddenly they feel people are noticing them and that it's important. It brought a tear to my eye the first opening that I did of kids singing and celebrating. It's marvellous. But the other context, and it's very relevant to it, is it's a stimulus measure, you know, to help keep us out of recession. We're one of the very few developed countries that stayed out of recession. To do the sorts of investments that you're talking about would not have been feasible in terms of stimulus. But we are investing in the infrastructure of universities. And the Bradley Review, which Julia Gillard is implementing, means that we are not just giving more money, but we are making it more open and more competitive as between universities. You've probably got the message from my personal view. I think competition is really important. Some people go, oh, it's bad for business. Competition's good for business. Competition's good for universities because it makes them sharpen up and, you know, offer different and very responsive offerings to students rather than just say, here's the formula as given to us from Canberra. But I agree with you, it's been a very badly neglected area. And I think, I don't want to get very political here, I really don't, but there was a very strong debate in the previous parliaments when we were in opposition that Labor was all elitist because we were interested in investing in universities, not in training. Well, we're interested in investing in both. But why can't the kids from poor families go to university as well as the kids from better off families?
Just a little comment about, I'd like to ask you to comment on this. I noticed in Paris, or in the French post office, how slow they were, the Australian post office shines by comparison. Now, increases in productivity, there must come a point where there can be no more increases. But I would think in the post office, for instance, here, there can't be any more increases. Would you like to comment on that?
Well, I think the enabling technologies do allow for increases in productivity. Some of those technologies are not yet imagined. And if we had the same conversation in 10 years' time, we'd say, wow, look what they now do in terms of Australia Post, given the technologies available on the internet, for example. So as I said in the speech, and it's a really important point, productivity is not about growth. It's not about working harder and having the Australia Post workers coming in earlier and working, nor is it about working longer. This work till you drop concept that was around a few years ago. I think Peter Costello said there'll be no such thing as full-time retirement. Well, if people want to retire, they should be able to retire and not be obliged to keep working. If they want to keep working, they shouldn't be prevented from keeping working. So I think if we think more of the enabling technologies and the almost boundless opportunities there, there will be improvements in productivity growth in Australia Post and other such places. One of the reasons that they're very good in terms of freight, that is packages beyond the 50-cent standard letter, is there is competition and they have to be sharp. But I tend to agree with you, in the standard 50-cent letter, we don't get a lot of complaints about Australia Post, you know, being slow and rude or inefficient, because they're pretty sharp there too.
Final question, John.
Yes, Minister. One element of productivity I don't think you touched on was portability of the workforce. I know Minister Gillard has talked about, you know, go West Young women. How can you get the kids from Barradine, the pointy heads, and the other kids?
The cool guys, too.
And the cools and non-cools, and the kids from Logan. How do you get them to the places that are the emerging place of workforce for those kids that mightn't be at the pointy end of the education revolution?
Yeah. Look, I think it's a really good question and a vital question for our future. This is a personal view. I think sometimes the kids don't have the confidence. They just don't think they can do it. And the education system, whether it's universities or whether it's a vocational stream, we need to inculcate in those sorts of kids that they are bright and creative and really able. It's when people lack confidence, they tend to stay where they are. So I'm not sure that there's a lot of the old rigidities. You see, the old rigidities would have said, you stay in textile, clothing and footwear, and your real wages will continue to fall, but we'll just keep protecting those industries. And so the cost of textile, clothing and footwear to poor consumers will go up, real wages won't go up, and it can be a pretty ordinary existence for people. So we've removed a lot of those rigidities, but we've got to continue doing it. And in the 27 areas of regulatory reform, one of the things that we're doing is that we are going to make a trade licence, whether it be a plumber or an electrician or some other tradesperson, good in one state, also good in every other state. You don't get stopped at the border between South Australia and Western Australia and ask for your Western Australian driver's licence. Your South Australian driver's licence is good. Well, why shouldn't your Queensland electrician's licence be good in Western Australia? At the moment, unbelievably, it's not. You have to apply for an electrician's licence in Western Australia. We're getting rid of that.
Minister, many thanks. Take a seat.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
Well, a competition minister's job is not all that an easy one, and so Craig Emerson is perhaps best known for his question time performances, occasional singing appearances on the rugby field and matters like that, and Q&A appearances and whatever else, but the truth is he's one of the real stars of the Rudd government, and has been a constant advocate of economic reform and competition reform within the Rudd government. I first met the minister, you may not remember, 25 years ago working in Canberra for the coalition, and the minister was working for Bob Hawke, and he used to be around the office, and he was talking about economic reform, and 25 years later he's still talking about economic reform, but in that period, both in the Hawke government and subsequently, he's played a very important role in this debate, which has held Australia up so well in the current economic crisis. So we're very pleased you've come to the Institute now on the second occasion as a government minister to talk about competition and related matters. I'm sure you'll be back again, but in the meantime, thanks for tonight and well done. Thank you.
Thank you. You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.